Welcome to Roundtable Talk, a podcast about longevity, senior services marketing, and the quality of life as one ages. Roundtable Talk is brought to you by Pavone Group and Varsity, a senior services agency focused on helping clients win the mature market. If you like the fresh perspectives we deliver in each episode, please give Roundtable Talk a 5-star review on the podcast service of your choice.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Varsity's Roundtable Talk. Today's guest is Lindsay Beagley. Lindsay is on the Executive Council of the Age Friendly University Global Network and is Senior Director of Lifelong University Engagement at Mirabella at Arizona State University. Lindsay works at the intersection of higher education and senior living, creating opportunities for senior living residents to fully immerse themselves in campus life at Arizona State. With a background spanning the Peace Corps, aging services, and higher education, Lindsay is redefining what it means to age with purpose. Welcome, Lindsay.
Thank you so much. It's good to talk to you, Derek.
Absolutely. Thanks for joining us. And you were on one of our live weekly roundtables a couple months back and really added a lot. So thank you for joining us here on the podcast.
Thanks so much. Glad to see you've got a podcast now.
Indeed. I want to start by taking a few minutes to have you talk about your work on the Age Friendly University Global Network. Tell us a little about the network and its vision.
Sure. So this is an association that started in 2012 at Dublin City University. And today, 12 years later, we've got 100 institutions, academic institutions worldwide that have signed on to this idea that universities should be a place that promotes learning for every generation, for every stage of life. And that has structural implications, right? That we have to think through, how do we make our campuses and our universities accessible and more friendly towards older learners who might not be in that traditional age of 18 to 25. That's sort of the traditional stage of life that universities often serve. So we've got now 100 universities who have signed on to 10 principles of age-friendly universities. These 10 principles offer sort of a flexible framework for every institution to adopt and to internalize whatever that means for them within their own context. Some of my very favorite principles, for example, include this idea that older learners should be a part of the core activities of the institution. Not that lifelong learning should be an afterthought, or, you know, some people think of lifelong learning as sort of something that happens outside of the core operations of the university. But these principles say, no, older learners should be involved, deeply integral into the core activities of the university.
I love that.
Yeah, I mean, that's really kind of a distinctive shift in our thinking, right? I think another principle that's really near and dear to my heart is this idea of promoting intergenerational connections, that a college campus is uniquely positioned to connect generations around a shared love of learning, a shared interest in a topic that neither of them perhaps have expertise in. And that's really one way that we can create social cohesion across generations, which we know is good for our society. Another one that I think is really important is the principle that we should, as universities, recognize a range of educational needs for older learners. Meaning these are learners who, you know, may have tried college and stopped out and maybe are looking for a pathway back. Maybe they got a degree and they're looking to pursue a second career as we live longer lives and we see careers spanning 60 years in some cases. A lot of people are going back to school to pivot and to transition to something different later on in their life. Universities need to be prepared to meet the needs that look more like that.
That's fascinating. And, you know, when you talk about being accessible, I think it's easy to go to, you know, the ADA accessibility and that sort of thing, and can people get in and out of the buildings and maneuver around the campus? But you're talking about accessibility much more broadly, right?
That's right, exactly. And think about, you know, yes, they need to be able to, you know, not trip on uneven cobblestone or whatever the case may be on campus, but also think about, you know, 21st century universities are highly technology enabled. So how are we making these learning experiences, which are, you know, in many cases online, even if they are in-person classes, they have some kind of online component. How do we think about supporting people with technology barriers, whether they are older or whether they're just not, didn't have exposure to technology growing up, we need to be thinking about how to close that digital divide for learners of all ages.
That's great. That's great. Now, how did you get involved with the network?
Gosh, you know, it's such an interesting place to be at the intersection of higher education and longevity. But I really feel like I was made for this work. I would say that my position at Mirabella sort of positioned me to contribute or know about Age-Friendly University Global Network early on. But what happened is that in 2023, the network actually transitioned to Arizona State University from Dublin City University. So it started at DCU, and after 12 years of expanding to 100 institutions, it moved to Arizona State University, which was one of the three initiating partners, together with Strathclyde University. So we are now in charge of expanding it to its next phase.
That's great. And did you work in senior living prior to Mirabella?
Actually, no, but I did have some exposure as a home and community-based services caseworker. And I would say, you know, so this is right out of college. I'm, you know, getting calls from people who have an interesting dilemma. I get calls from people who they say, I need some kind of support service, but I actually don't have medical needs. I'm not eligible for, you know, Medicaid. I don't have health needs, but I actually just need like somebody a few hours a day to help me around my house. Because as it turns out, people who are aging in place independently in their homes and communities find that, you know, living in these big houses all by themselves with no informal caregivers nearby, find that there's lots of challenges to keeping, mm-hmm. Maintaining a house. And so I think this was early on something that seeded in my brain as, okay, wow, we've got a gap in services here. We've got a need that isn't being met by existing support. They don't need home and community-based services, but they're not in any hurry to leave their home. And so how can we start to stitch together, you know, what the community actually needs?
That's great. So tell us a little bit more about Mirabella at Arizona State and your role there.
Yeah. So Mirabella at ASU is a university retirement community, and it's actually the first certified university-based retirement community in the entire country. What that means is that it's a continuing care retirement community, right? Vast majority of it is independent living. It has assisted living, memory support, and skilled nursing. But it actually sits on the college campus. And so it's called a university retirement community because it has that connectivity with the university. University-based retirement community is sort of the highest tier of university partnership strength, you could say. And so Mirabella at ASU not only is on campus land, but we also have three full-time dedicated staff that are entirely dedicated to supporting residents' integration into the campus community. That means enrolling them in classes. That means plugging them into mentoring roles or whatever it is they want to get involved in on campus. So it's an exciting model that I would say is not, you know, pieces of it are not new, but it's starting to gain traction as we see more and more older adults finding that they want to be intellectually stimulated, they want intergenerational connections, they want to be active. This is a great option for people who want that.
That's really interesting. So I've seen different types of models of late, but are there classrooms right in the community as well as, so that you have students coming into the community itself and really having that kind of intergenerational vibe?
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, I would point to its location on campus as one of the most important design choices that was made for this particular project. Because what it means is that there is no boundary, there is no barrier between the community and the campus community, right? There's this really beautiful, organic, fluid exchange. There are students coming into the building. A lot of times students host their student clubs there that residents participate in, or they enjoy some of our rooms as practice space if they're musicians. So we have students in the building all the time. We want that. We also have residents on campus all the time. They don't have to arrange transportation. They don't have to have a reason to go on campus. They just go downstairs and get a cup of coffee, walk their dog, run into, you know, a professor in the cafe. I mean, these are the kind of organic exposures and interactions that I feel are the most powerful part of this model.
That's great. That's great. And so I guess looking at the network broadly, what are some examples of the network in action? And what have you or the network learned that can be applied to age-friendly learning or senior living where they're not actually on a college campus or even adjacent to one? But what are some of those principles that you think can be applied?
Yeah, sure. Well, I think you hit the nail on the head. One of the things that we have learned is that these 10 principles need to be flexible. They need to be implemented in ways that make sense for each institution, for each community. Because the reality is, while institutions of higher education are, you know, bureaucratic institutions governed by accredited, you know, body, they're really, really unique. They're really place-based. They're really anchored in the unique communities and cities of which they are a part. And so you can't sort of say, this is what an age-friendly university looks like. The university needs to internalize the principles and needs to operationalize them based on the assets that they have to deploy to older learners. They need to determine what are the priorities that their stakeholders, that their leadership can get on board with. And so, you know, that's sort of the primary lesson learned, is that every institution sort of needs to chart their own path for becoming an age-friendly university.
That's great. That's great. Thank you. So going back a little bit further, you kind of alluded to it, but you started a home sharing agency that paired older adults with college students. Tell us about that experience and how it influenced your work at Mirabella.
Yeah, I would say that was definitely a pivotal point in my career trajectory. So I had mentioned I sort of had this seedling of a thought that that there are people who are, I guess, what we call now house rich and income poor, right? They are on fixed budgets. They don't have a lot of money to outsource for supports that they might need to maintain their house, yard work, pet care, you know, maintenance, house maintenance, whatever the case may be. But they have big houses, lots of room. And at the time I was working at the university and I was a grad student and working there, and I was starting to become aware of the extent to which my classmates were taking out exorbitant loan debt to cover not just their tuition, but their living expenses. And so here I am aware that we have this enormous supply of people with big houses, empty rooms that are just sitting there. And here are students struggling to complete, you know, to finish their educational endeavors and are sinking themselves into debt just to be able to find affordable housing anywhere near campus. And so it became clear that I might be the only person who is seeing both things happen at the same time. So I did some research to find out, is this a real thing? Is this a model? There's a model all over the world called home sharing. And at the time in 2016, 2017, there was about 16 in the United States, but nothing in Arizona. And as you probably know, Arizona is sort of a retirement destination. And so we have a lot of people who live out here in these, you know, big houses, but no family nearby, nobody who can pop over and help them with something in the house. So it really seemed like a great opportunity to develop a home sharing agency here in Arizona. And, you know, at the time, and even now, it's still sort of the next frontier of the sharing economy, right? We're comfortable with Airbnbs. We're comfortable with, you know, renting out our houses when we're not living in them. We're comfortable getting in each other's cars, for Uber and Lyft, but, you know, living in a house while the owner is still living there seems, you know, one step too far. So I would often get this reaction, oh, that's a great idea, but not for me. You know, I need my space. I need my privacy. And so I thought, you know, what will it take to overcome this sense of risk of uniting two lives in a home? And I pulled together focus groups of older homeowners in the Valley, Valley of the Sun, Phoenix metro area. And it was very surprising because I got almost unanimously some version of the answer. We love the idea of helping a student succeed. And this was such a tremendous surprise to me because I thought that this model would help them. I thought this model would help them live independently in their homes. But what I learned is they don't see it that way. They see themselves as the asset in this equation. they see themselves as the one that has something to give, and that they were only willing to overcome the risk if it meant that they could help a student. This was paradigm shifting. I mean, right? It's very different than the messages we typically hear around aging services. And I thought, we have it all wrong. We're talking about older adults all wrong. Instead of what do they need? How can we help them live independently? We should be asking ourselves, how can we tap the enormous reserve of human capital that they represent? The enormous trove of wisdom and life experience and resources that they represent. They see themselves that way, and that's the messaging that resonates with them.
That's really cool. Just kind of, you know, to the point you were making, flipping it on its ear kind of and thinking about it completely differently. And, you know, I guess it's a classic win-win, right? Where both sides are giving something and both sides are getting something in return. And, but no, that's really cool.
Yeah. I think honestly that changed the way that I saw Mirabella. When Mirabella, you know, when it was announced that ASU was going to break ground on Mirabella, I think most people thought, okay, this is a great way to expand lifelong learning and give these people more learning opportunities. But I saw it as, oh my gosh, these students are going to get to interact with these folks. They're going to get a chance to connect with somebody who has 60-year career behind them. And I could see that the real value of this model is how were these 400 residents living on campus going to benefit and support student success.
That's great. That's great. Thank you for sharing that. Now, before that, you were in the Peace Corps in Honduras, and you've talked about observing intergenerational connections there. Talk a little about what you saw and what you experienced in the Peace Corps.
Sure. This is probably the first point at which I realized there was something special about intergenerational connections that we're not fully leveraging. So, you know, I think anytime you're traveling somewhere else, I think it's normal to compare wherever you're traveling with what you're used to. And, you know, you say, oh, it's not the way we do it in the United States, which is not an enlightened way to travel, but very human and normal. But when you live somebody for an extended period of time, and Peace Corps is 2.5 years, the reverse starts to happen, where you start to really settle into the experience that you're having and the way that other people live, and you let it sort of shape you, and you start to appreciate the complexity and the nuances of other ways of living. And I think one of the things that really shaped how I see the world is appreciating the value of intergenerational households, where, you know, you of course got the adults in the family, the adult children in the family going off to earn an income for everyone. And then you have the older adults who stay home and, you know, cook and oversee the kids and pass on traditions. And they have an incredibly important role in the family, and they are needed, and they are included in every part of life. And children get to have a relationship with their grandparents, and they know where they come from, and they have a sense of belonging, and they know where their traditions are. And even in the most devastated parts of the country that were, you know, still recovering from Hurricane Mitch, which had happened 15 years prior, I saw such enormous resilience in those communities, and I really attribute it to these intergenerational households. So I got back to the States and I thought, oh, the U.S. has it all wrong. Mm-hmm. I could see that we didn't have this mechanism largely, and we had in fact intentionally designed it out. Arizona, my home state, you know, is the birthplace of Sun City, the age segregated, geographically isolated retirement community. And I could see that we had some work to do to start to stitch generations back together.
I think that's really smart, because you're right. As we have gotten more mobile as a society, as you know, I guess we've gotten more resources socioeconomically, we are able to move around, and it has detached us a lot from you know, the generations. So, right. And just as you were talking, it made me spark something I saw this summer. I saw an older gentleman with, you know, a young boy, and I'm sure it was his, well, I know it was his grandchild because of the t-shirts they were wearing. He said, his t-shirt said, "I learned cool things from my grandson," and his, and the kid said, "I learned cool things from my grandpa." And I thought that was a really cool way to just tie them together and make people realize that, you know, generations can learn from each other, and that that's, that is so important.
Absolutely. I think we've, you know, one of the consequences of having designed out an older generation is that we now don't really know how to talk to one another across generations. We don't know how to talk to somebody that's not working any longer. What do you ask them about? How do you connect? How do you find things you relate to? And you know, the other piece is that older people have forgotten what it's like to be young, but also young people have also not developed the skill to project their future selves, which is so important. It means that you can make decisions now that will benefit the future version of you. But if you can't see the future version of you, that's going to really influence how you make decisions in your life. So it's so important that we find ways to connect with one another.
That's great. And I don't know if you've ever met or spoken with Dr. Geber, Dr. Sarah Zeff Geber. We had her on a podcast two or three episodes ago, and she really has coined the term solo ager. And, you know, just that whole, the need for that intergenerational connection emotionally and psychologically, but also practically. I mean, you mentioned with the home sharing and having, you know, someone who can be a part of your life and perhaps help you as you have, you know, certain needs at least.
Mm, indeed. And truly you don't even know how you might use their help. But having just sort of regular connectivity with somebody that has a different perspective and different life experience, you come to realize, wow, I've benefited so much from them. I don't even know that I would have sought out that information intentionally. And that's, I think, the beauty of having diversity of age in your world.
That's great. Yeah, no, I definitely agree. Now, Mirabella at ASU is described as a living laboratory. What does that mean to be a living laboratory?
Yeah. Well, you know, the incoming cohort of retirees is baby boomers, right? And we know that baby boomers have historically shaped consumer tastes from the beginning of their lives, really. And that's no different right now. I mean, all of us in this industry are trying to figure out what is it that baby boomers want? They are patently rejecting the status quo. They are saying, I don't want to live I don't want to live 30 years of leisure. And they're also experiencing longer lifespans than we've seen before. So we don't really know what they want. How do they want to live? What do they want to learn? How do they want to engage? So I see Mirabella because it's right on campus and because every single resident is given a student ID card that grants them access to anywhere on campus.
That's fantastic.
We've opened up every door of the campus to them. And I really think it's the university's opportunity to learn. What is it that they want to learn? How do they want to learn? How do they want to engage with the resources and experiences that the university offers? And so for me, it's an opportunity to challenge our assumptions about what we think older adults want and also experiment. How can we connect generations? How can we connect students and residents and not feel like it's forced? You know, what are the good strategies and the mechanisms for doing that? We can try things on, see how it works and just do the things that work.
That's great. So can you share some of the most innovative or surprising ways that residents are engaging on campus or interacting with other, you know, I don't want to say more traditional students, but I guess, you know, the quote unquote college age student.
Yeah, I love this. You know, it's interesting. There's about 330 residents, and truly there are 330 very different experiences because we're not prescribing for them how they should interact with campus. And so sometimes I don't know about it until after the fact. Sometimes they'll tell me, you know, I've been doing this thing for 3 months and I I love that. I love that I don't have to broker every single engagement opportunity. They're out there, sort of carving their own paths and creating support roles that truly don't exist or even really have names. So for example, I'm thinking of one gentleman who I talked to before he moved in, and he said, you know, I'm a retired gastroenterologist. I want to connect with students who are pre-med, you know, on a pre-med track and just help them however I can. And I didn't really know what that meant at the time, but I checked with our College of Health Solutions, that where all of our pre-med students are housed. And he started a group with four other retired physicians, and they've been meeting every single month for the last 2 years. And the students drive the agenda. They say whatever topic is weighing on them, and it has ranged from physician burnout and suicide to how do I finance my medical education? What is the business side of healthcare delivery? And so these are all questions that they have that their curriculum isn't giving them, and that their faculty who weren't never practicing physicians can't give them from their own lived experience. And it's such an extraordinary group, because it's now grown to the point where the college is granting the students credit for participating, because it has been so valuable to them.
That's great. Now, I'm curious, you know, you referenced how some of the academicians didn't have the life experience, the career experience to fill in some of that blank. Are they embracing the older adults who are kind of complementing the curriculum with this?
Absolutely. In fact, from that very same group, they've had some of the docs record some of their stories and be interviewed, so that they can use that footage for both online classes, but also make sure that they capture it. So as time goes on, they can use it in different contexts or with different classes. And you don't have to be a member of this one on-campus group to benefit from their wisdom.
That's great. That's great. So I know you mentioned that a lot of this happens organically, or people are finding their own path, but how does Ms. Mirabella ensure that the residents not only feel welcome on campus, but also feel like they're an integral part of the Arizona State community?
Yeah, good question. The two things that I would point to, again, I think the location is the first most important thing. And I know not all university retirement communities can achieve, you know, that level of proximity, but I do think there's power in removing as many geographical barriers as possible, because what it means is they're as integral to campus as, you know, the School of Art building next door and all the faculty and students in it. They belong there because they physically occupy space there. It also signals that the university is deeply invested in it. This is not just something that happened on the outskirts of campus. This is something the university wanted. And so I think, you know, location, I would say, is number one. But second is that student ID card that every single resident gets, because, yes, it both functionally allows them to enter into any campus facility or space, but it also signals to them and everyone else, this person belongs here. This person is a member. And I even had, you know, a couple of residents move in who I was surprised at how important this moment was in the process of moving, is the moment they get their student ID card. It's almost like you are no longer a retired, you know, real estate broker or whatever it is you were before. And I think so many folks, you know, at 75, let's say, no longer identify with their careers, right? They don't want to keep saying, I'm a retired physician, I'm a retired real estate broker. I want to say, I'm a learner, I'm a student, I'm a mentor, I'm a whatever it is I'm doing now.
I have value now.
I have an identity, a valued post-career identity. And I think that's what that student ID card represents. So I would say that that's another design choice that's critical.
That's a great point. So with the residents and the older adults accessing, you know, in various parts of the campus, as well as programming, what's the reaction been from the students? How have they responded to learning alongside, in some cases, you know, octogenarians, nonagenarians?
Yeah. It's a good question. I've actually looked pretty deeply into this, because I think this is the most important perspective. If we want universities to embrace these models, we need to know that this is a good thing for students who are the primary beneficiaries of universities, right? And I will say, there are, particularly in spaces where, you know, it's a lecture hall or it's a lot of people, I would say most students assume that our older adult learners are faculty who are observing, or right, they just assume that if you're an older person, you must be working there. But when they find out that they are students, that they are learners in the class, some of them really have a hard time wrapping their mind around the idea that at some point their learning will not be guided by a program of study, that at some point they will want to return to this university or to their college experience. and guide their own learning. And that's almost inconceivable to a 20-year-old who just, you know, they're at this point in their life when every decision is guided by like, what do I got to do to graduate? What do I got to do to get the job?
It's almost like they're buying their career. You know, it's a transaction for some folks.
Yeah. And I think at that point, they're very extrinsically motivated. But here they encounter someone who is deeply intrinsically motivated to have this experience that they're, you know, they feel like they have to have.
That's a really great point.
It's such a beautiful thing to see, like, that click for a student. Like, hey, you're in a place that's a privilege. You're this learning that you're experiencing, you're going to want that when you leave. I have, you know, this anecdote of a resident who came back from class just glowing, and she was taking a sustainability course. And after the lecture, she was just filled with hope. And, you know, she had just learned about all of these innovations to overcome climate change, and they all sounded very promising. And she just felt really alive and excited. And she leans over to her classmate and she's like, wasn't that great? And he just, his face was, you know, sullen, and he was experiencing overwhelm and this doom and gloom of the enormity of the climate action crisis. And for 15 or 20 minutes after class, they talked about how do we have such different perspectives on the same lecture? These are these moments, Derek, that I'm like, oh, this is the stuff that I think is where the real learning happens, right? Because that student got to benefit from Karen's 86 years of life, where she's seen big and heavy things come and go. And she also got to learn that young people are very, very stressed out by the things that they're experiencing and the things that they're learning. And for them to have that discussion, I mean, that's some beautiful learning right there.
Absolutely. And, you know, I know that critical thinking is something that we all as a society need to make sure that we are fostering, and that we're not just simply relying on the technology, and now with AI and other things where it almost seems like it's easy to come up with answers. But to be able to think through it like that and multi-generationally, intergenerationally, I think is really a pretty amazing experience.
Agreed. It's almost like the counterpoint to AI.
Yep, exactly. it's RI, I guess, real intelligence. So how does Mirabella balance offering traditional senior living services such as assisted living and memory care with its focus on the university engagement and lifelong learning and those kinds of topics?
Yeah. Well, you know, as I mentioned, at its core, it's a CCRC or a life plan community. So it offers everything that a resident could need, but it's wrapped in it's sort of wrapped in a package that resonates with who they feel they are. So, you know, they may need at some point a higher level of care and not be able to fully access all of the things on campus. I mean, ASU is an enormous university. It's a lot of walking if you're going to, you really get your step count in when you're on campus. But because of its location, we're able to bring the university into the community so that even those with mobility challenges or for whatever reason aren't able to fully take advantage of the university, you know, we have a faculty member every single Thursday at 3 p.m. that comes in and gives a different lecture, or, you know, a new faculty member every week. We've got students performing in the building. We have students living in the building that do all of our musical programming. I mean, we bring the university to them. And so I think you can really say that you get what you need in terms of care as you age, but also you get what you want in terms of learning and engagement, intellectual stimulation.
That's great. That's great. And I think it is, and I've not had the pleasure of visiting Mirabella or Arizona State. I would love to. I'd love to. But it feels like it's just very seamless. And you know, like there are no, you know, real barriers. I mean, obviously, as we age, there are certain limitations we have, but that's amazing. But shifting gears just a little bit, this is a question I like to ask every roundtable talk guest. What are you looking forward to as you age?
This is such a good question, Derek. I love the way you ask it because it signals that you're Q3 and Q4 are stages of life to look forward to. And I think that's right. I mean, I really have the privilege of watching people experiment with new identities and learn things that that weren't even available to them as they were coming up in the world. So I guess as I watch them grow and explore and blossom in these later stages of life, I think, wow, wouldn't it be lovely to be able to explore things on my own terms? You know, at this point in my life, I'm squarely in Q2 and I'm like, you know, I'm a mother and I'm an employee and I'm a wife and I'm a doctoral student and every hour of my day is spoken for and I've got obligations in so many domains of my life. But I can imagine this time of life where I don't have to do anything that doesn't completely light me up, and that I can use my knowledge and skills for whatever purpose I want to invest in. And I'd love that idea.
That's great. So for current communities, life plan communities and such that don't have a formal relationship with a college, what advice would you give them, you know, as they're looking to foster meaningful relationships, you know, on an intergenerational basis?
Yeah. Well, sort of going with the theme of flipping the paradigm on its head, one of the things that I think is an important way to approach a partnership at the university is to ask them, what do students need? What do your academic units need? And you may be surprised to find that your community has a treasure trove of people with a particular area of expertise, with time, knowledge, and that somehow you can create a collaboration that actually addresses the needs of our students. And I think that's an important approach because as you know, I think a typical collaboration often looks like, well, let's have students go out and do community service at a senior living community. Let's have them go and sing or spend time. And that's fine and good. But wow, how compelling is it when you say, what do you need? What do you need, students? What do your students need? And sometimes it might, I think it might surprise folks that one of the things universities struggle with is when they need mentors or when they need some kind of support resource, it's difficult to ask a working professional to do that. These are people with, you know, they've got full-time jobs and many other obligations and sitting on boards and whatever the case may be. But if that university needs three judges to be judges for their student venture pitch competition, and it's a Saturday obligation for 3 hours, I mean, what a cool opportunity would that be to give somebody living in a senior community that had a career of business experience? I think you'd be surprised at what kind of collaborations can occur when you take that tap.
That's great. No, I love that, how you're really trying to see how you can plug in and what, you know, really listen to what the needs might be. But likewise for universities that don't have a relationship with the senior living community, if anybody, you know, is listening in that camp, what can universities do to create a more age-friendly environment for older adults?
Yeah. Well, I mean, unfortunately, I think the sector is slow to adapt, but it's at a moment when universities are having to think differently about who their learners are and what they offer, because the reality is that concurrent with the longevity boom is what universities call the enrollment cliff, which is, you know, fertility decline has gotten to the point where there just aren't enough 18-year-olds who want to go to university right after high school anymore. So if a university's only pipeline of incoming freshmen is 18-year-olds from high school, they are in big trouble right now. And I think that is a reality in the sector that we're having to grapple with. But perhaps it's, you know, necessity is the mother of invention here. And maybe that means that more and more universities can start to think about learners from different age groups that might become, might expand their learner segment.
That's smart. Yeah. And I do know that, you know, colleges and universities, certainly in our area, are experiencing downturns in enrollment, and it's, you're creating some real, you know, budgetary issues.
Indeed. Yep.
Now, I think you've talked a little bit about this, but intergenerational connections are a recurring theme in your work. Why do you think these relationships are so impactful for both the older and the younger generations?
Yeah, it's true. It's a driving aspiration in my work. And the reality is there is a great body of literature about the value of intergenerational connections. We know that for young adults, You see increased civic engagement, increased entrepreneurship, increased sense of belonging, self-esteem, self-efficacy. For older adults, you see some of the same things, greater sense of purpose, but you also see increased cognitive sharpness and reduced frailty and fall risk. I mean, so there are physical and socio-emotional benefits. We've got an enormous body of literature to support this, and yet it seems to be ageism is the thing that gets in the way. And so I think, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think that's probably the biggest lever here is how do we get past our old ideas about what older adulthood is about so that we can reap the benefits of intergenerational connection.
Sure. No, and related to that, what are some of those misconceptions people have about building those connections, and how can you possibly overcome them?
Yeah, it's really the holy grail question, isn't it? Well, like I said, I think if I were to advise, you know, a university in creating those partnerships or a senior living community for that matter, is to think about like what do the students need? How can we start to frame, characterize older adults as the resource, as the asset, as the reserve of, you know, this natural abundant reserve of human capital. I think really that's what we have to start thinking about instead of, oh no, if I hear one more time somebody say the silver tsunami, and I'm like, oh, not only, you know, is that terribly ageist, but it sort of signals that this is something that we didn't know was coming, that it's a catastrophe to prevent instead of here is this incredible opportunity that we have to harness.
You know, I think you mentioned this earlier in our conversation, but about how, you know, there, I guess you mentioned it as related to the 300 and some odd folks who live at Mirabella, and each one has their own experience. I think when you bundle, I mean, it's natural in the, you know, the business world and reporting and everything else to kind of aggregate different groups of people. But yeah, when you say silver tsunami, it lumps everybody together and I think really devalues a lot of what, you know, the individualism is.
Absolutely. And, you know, we do this. This is crazy to me to do this at 65 plus, which means you're sort of aggregating the last third of life and creating a monolith for it, a negative one at that. And what lost opportunity and what lost creativity and that simple vernacular that we just can't let go of. But if we can let it go of it, we can start to create different language, different narratives, different milestones that occur after retirement that signal continued human growth and flourishing. I mean, that's really what the opportunity is really making the most out of this extended lifespan that we've achieved.
That's great. That's great. So research suggests that older adults who interact with younger generations experience physical benefits such as reduced risk of falls. What do you believe are the most significant psychological or emotional benefits?
Sense of purpose. I mean, you know, this is what I see every day. In fact, one of my residents said the other day that she was experiencing one of those days where typically she wouldn't want to get out of bed. But she had a lunch with a student that day and she's like, I gotta go, they're expecting me. And so she's like, I just pulled myself out of bed and I went and it was wonderful and I'm so glad that I went. And it's those things that, you know, if you don't have a purpose, if you don't have something to go to where you're expected and you're needed and you're valued, then you won't pull yourself out of bed. And so, you know, with that comes the sense of despair, the sense of irrelevance, depression, and that's the trigger for cognitive decline. So sense of purpose.
That's great. That's great. Now, you've spoken about the Renaissance period for those aged 65 to 85. What advice would you give to individuals who are in that age group? And I'm sure you've interacted with many over the years, looking to rediscover that purpose or engage in lifelong learning. What advice would you give them?
Well, I would say it is really hard to embrace a beginner's mindset after you've had the experience of being a master in whatever your field is, right? I mean, if you've had the joy of mastery, where things come easy to you and you have a great trove of knowledge to pull from, it's hard to learn something new where you feel, you know, sort of stumbling through it. And, but the reality is that is how, that's when you know you're learning. All learning is hard. So I think it's fun to see, you know, a 76-year-old resident in Spanish 101, because guess what? Spanish 101 is hard for all of us. And so, it, you know, you see a 19-year-old stumbling through it, you see a 76-year-old stumbling through it. And that's the process of learning, is just pushing through the clunkiness of those first phases. And I guess I would just say embrace a beginner's mindset, because that's it's not crossword puzzles that keeps your mind sharp. It's navigating newness. It's encountering new ideas that challenge your thinking, that push you out of your comfort zone, that force you to reckon with what you thought you knew. That's the stuff that keeps your mind sharp.
You know, it is, it just made me think, so often I think people feel like, and it does happen to some degree, I'm probably experiencing it myself as I get older, but people are quote unquote set in their ways. But there's an awful lot, a huge segment of the older population isn't set in their ways. They may have, you know, lived experiences and such, but they do want to expand how they live their life, how they, you know, how they process information, what their view on the world is, and, you know, people can change.
Absolutely. And in fact, that's one of the exciting things about watching residents on campus, is they're bound to encounter something that they would never have encountered in their very curated, you know, home and life and social circle. And in fact, one of our most popular classes is called Pizza and a Slice of the Future. And every week they tackle some kind of new technology and what its implications are on society. It is overwhelmingly the most exciting and well-attended, well-enrolled class in our community. And I think it challenges the idea that older adults don't want to know about the future. Yeah, they do. They absolutely do. They're in a moment of legacy building. They want to know what how the next generation will fare. They want to know what the next generation will experience. And I think they're deeply invested.
That's great. That's amazing. So how many university-based retirement communities exist nationally? I'm sure there are some informal ones, but, you know, the ones that are, you know, part of the network. And are there any regions that are more prevalent?
Great question. Well, there is now a directory called universityretirementcommunities.com. And from what we can tell, at least self-identified communities, there's about 85 that have claimed some kind of affiliation with a university. And that could look like a lot of different things in terms of the formality of their relationship with their university, or the location, or the extent to which it was designed as such. Lots and lots of variability in there, but it's starting to become much more of an emergent trend. I think as universities are starting to think differently about how to innovate, senior living communities are starting to think differently about what sort of value proposition they're offering potential residents. We're seeing a lot of these come online. I couldn't tell you where there is maybe a cluster in the United States, but I can say that in Asian countries, Japan, China, South Korea specifically, where the fertility decline is so dramatic, universities are having to think very, very quickly. And university-based retirement communities have come up as something that they're very interested in investing in. So I would expect over the next few years to see quite a few come online in South Korea.
That's fascinating. So, you know, when we think about the age-friendly university global network, is there a formal relationship that you have, or is it more a think tank that's helping to, you know, let organizations, you know, benefit from the experience? Or, you know, is there a certification or licensing? Or talk a little bit about how that works, or, you know, how others can get involved with the network.
Yeah. So there is a formal membership process. Most universities go through some exercise of creating a working group to apply, to put together an application. And really the process is meant to help the institution galvanize what they already have and what it is they want out of becoming an age-friendly university. And the process itself is really, really important so that they can get stakeholders on board and socialize the idea. So that application is sent to the Executive Council for consideration. Once you are a member, I should also mention those applicants that are not formal academic institutions can apply for an affiliate membership. And in exciting news, one of the things that we're doing this year is creating a convening for age-friendly university members and also affiliates and other longevity leaders in higher education who want to start to share best practices of how do we create these cross-sector collaborations? What have we learned? What can we share with others who are aspiring to get on board? So more to come on that, but we're expecting it to be December 2025.
That's amazing. That's great. So what do you see as some of the biggest challenges and opportunities for expanding the network of university-based retirement communities?
Yeah, I mean, I think all cross-sector collaborations are difficult, right? They're challenging because one of the definitions of innovation is an unlikely pairing that when together creates something that is bigger than the sum of its parts. So university-based retirement community is a partnership between senior living and a university, two industries that never talk to one another, have very different, you know, regulatory environments and incentive structures and priorities. And it can be really challenging to create a shared vision and to create a shared language about what we're creating together. And I think that can be very overwhelming for two industries that are pretty formulaic, pretty used to doing things the way that they always have. But I really believe in the power of this model. I think that we are in for lots more innovation to come. I think this is, you know, university retirement communities are just one mechanism to achieve this future that I see for us. But I think there's a lot more out there.
That's interesting. As I was listening to you talk, something sparked, that you were saying. It really feels like the senior living communities and the universities, colleges, what have you, probably feel like their objectives are at odds or are very different, when in reality, they're pretty similar. You know, the universities are trying to provide that wonderful life-changing experience for students, and the same thing is really happening at senior living communities.
I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right. When you really go down to first principles, the purpose of the university is to educate the community, right? Particularly public institutions. Well, the community is looking older than it ever has before. So educating the community means educating learners of all ages and knowing what we know about the value of intellectual stimulation in later stages of life. I mean, that's really what senior living communities could achieve if they embrace sort of a learning-centered retirement experience.
Love that. That's amazing. Now, you'd mentioned early on in our discussion that you're pursuing your doctoral studies, I believe.
Yeah.
What is the subject or what's the focus?
My focus is intergenerational learning. Yeah. I think it became so clear that I was the beneficiary of a lot of anecdotes that don't really have a research basis. And I'm looking to kind of tie a lot of these things together to share with others what I'm seeing in this model.
That's great. Well, our very last question, and we ask this of everybody, what have you learned? And I know that you had mentioned you're in Q2 of mm-hmm. your life, but what have you learned that you wish you could have told your younger self? Mm.
Well, I guess I would say that if you're doing work that you feel a little bit alone doing, or you feel like everybody thinks you're crazy for doing it, that maybe you're onto something and just keep going.
That's great. Well said. Well, Lindsay, it's been a true pleasure. Thank you for joining us. Arizona State and Mirabella are both very fortunate to have you. And I'll be fascinated to see where the Age-Friendly University Global Network goes. It's a wonderful program, and I feel so fortunate to have learned more about it. One of our clients is Larksfield Place in Wichita, and they had shared that Wichita State is involved in this movement, which is what caused me to reach out to you and
wonderful.
Make the connection.
Yes. Thank you so much. It's such a wonderful chat. Appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you. And also thanks to Dave Schaffner, our producer, and Matt Campbell, our engineer, for putting everything together. And we'll see you next time on Roundtable Talk.